Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we're now in our fall pledge drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online to kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Once again, thanks for supporting KBOO. For over 5 years, the threat of being the site for the world's largest methanol refinery has loomed over the small community of Kalama, Washington, 40 miles north of Portland. This month, the Washington Department of Ecology released a new draft supplemental environmental impact statement. The comment period for the public to weigh in on the decision of whether or not to grant a shorelines permit for the methanol refinery has been going on all month, with a broad array of community voices urging Ecology to reject this proposal. Today, we talk again with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about region-wide concerns about the hazards of this methanol refinery. Dan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's great to be on.
Let's start by giving listeners who may not remember or know what the Kalama Methanol Refinery is all about, give us a little bit of background on the history of this project and what its impact would be on Southwest Washington.
This is a proposal that came into Southwest Washington along with two others. A company called Northwest Innovation Works proposed three different refineries, each of which would be the largest in the world, that would turn fracked gas into methanol at really a staggering scale. So these refineries would convert hundreds of millions of cubic feet of gas into methanol to be shipped overseas, targeting China. So initially, there were proposals in Tacoma, Kalama, and Port Westward, Oregon. The folks in Tacoma, Washington stopped the project there in 2016 and successfully shut that proposal down. And so Northwest Innovation Works, the company behind these ideas, really focused then on Kalama, Washington. And since 2016, they have really been pressing on this idea of building this very large methanol refinery in Kalama. So the project would use 320 million cubic feet of fracked gas a day. To give you some sense for how big that is, that's about a third of all the gas that Washington uses for all purposes in the entire state. That's more than the gas used for all the power plants in Washington. It's more than the gas used for all other major industrial users of gas. It's just a staggering commitment to an increase in fracked gas use in the state. And then more locally, there's a deep concern about what this could mean for the community of Kalama, with a huge plume of air pollution coming out of this facility, a kind of steam plume hovering over the facility that it could at times be thousands of feet high. Some folks live fairly close to this proposed refinery facility, you know, within a mile or two, and are concerned about the air quality impacts. Others are concerned about the general industrialization of this area. And then right now, what's really up for debate is the greenhouse gas pollution that would come from this facility. And the implications of the greenhouse gas impacts from this facility are really enormous. You know, it's pretty intuitive that building the world's largest gas to methanol refinery will have a really big greenhouse gas impact. And that's what folks in Kalama have been arguing, and around the region, people who take climate change seriously, including Governor Inslee, have come to the conclusion that no one in good conscience can really support this project anymore who recognizes that fossil fuels are not part of a path to limiting greenhouse gas pollution and limiting global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius. So the stakes are pretty high for this project, and the decisions are coming very soon.
In Tacoma, they were able to drive the methanol refinery out of town relatively fast. I think it was a matter of months before activists heard about it and when they finally forced Northwest Innovation Works out of town. And I'm wondering why it is that it was relatively easy for folks in Tacoma to get rid of the methanol refinery compared to the people in Kalama who've been fighting this for over 5 years.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a matter of ease in so much that people in Tacoma really were able to mobilize on a large scale quickly. It's a larger community, and I think they perceived a threat and responded on a pretty mass scale very quickly. I think the early meetings evaluating the project were attended by hundreds and hundreds of people. In Kalama, you know, it's a small community. There's only a couple thousand people who live there. And so Northwest Innovation Works fairly quickly had secured support from local elected leaders. They, you know, came in with a promise of creating jobs and kind of a big greenwashing message, which I think we've talked about on this before. And so they came in with a pretty slick message in a small community. You know, it was a challenge for people in this very, you know, small community to push back on that. And to their credit, 6 years later in Kalama, they're still fighting and this project has not been built. And in fact, they've really changed the course of the proposal, and they've actually helped to bring Governor Inslee around on the project and to see that, you know, building this type of huge fracked gas infrastructure is not consistent with the state's greenhouse gas goals. So I think Tacoma and Kalama have a lot in common in that, in the end, grassroots power and resistance makes the difference. It's a matter of what it takes to mobilize that. Sometimes in smaller, more rural communities, it can take more time. And I think it's a huge credit to the people in Kalama that they spent 5-6 years doing the research and kind of making a really compelling case that both the local and global impacts of this project would be unacceptable.
Well, it was just about a year ago that there was a big march on the Department of Ecology in Washington, and it came from Kalama and it came from Tacoma and converged there. People there, including most eloquently John Flynn, who's one of the leaders trying to stop the methanol refinery in Kalama, spoke eloquently to the Department of Ecology, calling on them to take over the project and to take it away from the hands and the purview of Cowlitz County and the Port of Kalama, who were responsible for writing the environmental impact statement and the supplemental environmental impact statement for the shoreline permit, which was what was under contention at the time. What was the upshot of that? It seems like they actually had at least some success in calling on the Department of Ecology to actually take some action.
That's right. I mean, the port and the county had really become mouthpieces for Northwest Innovation Works and were carrying water for them and pushing the Northwest Innovation Works agenda that this, you know, they were arguing that this massive refinery would actually take carbon out of the atmosphere. And that is not accurate, obviously. Beyond counterintuitive, it's really a tortured version of reality. And so the Kalama team had argued to the Department of Ecology that they needed to basically develop their own environmental analysis in order to get a clear picture of what the greenhouse gas impacts of this project would be. And you know, now we're in the midst of that.
What happened? Did the Department of Ecology actually take over writing the environmental impact statement from Cowlitz County and the Port of Kalama?
Sort of. What they did was they decided that for their own purposes, they needed to write a supplemental analysis. So really what it is a second supplemental environmental impact statement that narrowly looks at the greenhouse gas emissions of this project. It's a fairly focused supplemental environmental review that, you know, it doesn't look at the toxic air emissions. It doesn't look at the landslide risks along the pipeline route potentially or other issues. It just simply looks at the life cycle emissions coming from the fracking, the refinery itself, and the downstream uses of the methanol. That's the picture that Ecology decided it needed to get, you know, a clearer sense of. And they've written a supplemental environmental impact statement to address that. And that's where we are. We're sort of in the midst of that comment period today. So once they complete that analysis, they will make a decision on a key permit for the project called a shorelines permit. And this is basically a permit that allows a developer to do construction and operate a facility in the shorelines of Washington. So Washington has, you know, pretty clear standards for saying that you need to protect the shorelines of Washington, and there are standards in Washington for protecting the entire state, including the shorelines, from the impacts of global warming and climate change. And so this sort of directly relates to the impacts from this project.
Well, it seemed like a lot of the arguments 2 years ago when the initial supplemental environmental impact statement was being commented on and debated and then approved by the Port of Kalama and Cowlitz County, that there was concerns about just how much greenhouse gas was going to be created by this project. And people at the time who opposed the methanol refinery were arguing that there was not serious consideration of the upstream and the downstream emissions. And so when that SEIS came out, it was addressing them, but with these strange figures that people were debating about the scientific veracity of that. And it seems that my sense was that ecology actually agreed with the arguments that the original SEIS didn't accurately address those greenhouse gas emissions. So what's the difference between what that original SEIS was and what the second SEIS is saying?
So ecology went further with the second environmental impact statement in addressing what the pollution impacts would be from, you know, fracking the gas out of the ground, delivering it to the Klama refinery, and then using that methanol in an overseas market. They did that in a couple ways. They used a slightly higher rate for how much methane escapes during the fracking process, and they assumed that some of the methanol would be burned overseas, which is something that Northwest Innovation Works refused to acknowledge, despite the fact that Northwest Innovation Works had told potential investors that some or all of the methanol could be burned. They were promoting the use of methanol as a fuel to their investors, or potential investors, I should say. So the Department of Ecology, when they did this, you know, somewhat more robust analysis, came up with a conclusion that the project would produce, really on the low end, about 4.6 million tons of greenhouse gas pollution each year. And that is really where the analysis should have stopped. I mean, that's a very clear-cut, massive amount of pollution. It would put the Kalama project among the top polluters in the state of Washington. And actually, the numbers get worse when you use some more unfavorable assumptions for Northwest Innovation Works. For instance, if you were to use a higher methane pollution rate for the upstream pollution, say 3% of the methane leaking through the fracking process, the number gets dramatically higher and goes up closer to 9 million tons per year. And then if you were to assume that all of that methanol were to be burned, the number goes even higher than that. So you're looking at really a massive, massive polluter in terms of greenhouse gas pollution. You know, this is something that we think is a stark conclusion from the supplemental environmental impact statement and a basis for the Department of Ecology to deny the project. The in-state pollution from the project alone would be roughly 1 million tons of greenhouse gas pollution each year. And so what we have urged the Department of Ecology to do is to focus their decision-making on what is reasonably foreseeable, what is knowable. And that's that, you know, if you build a massive fracked gas to methanol refinery, you're going to get a ton of pollution. You're going to get millions and millions of tons of pollution. And that is profoundly inconsistent with meeting Washington's greenhouse gas reduction goals. It's also profoundly inconsistent with any low carbon pathway that creates a livable future for the next generations. And this is the message that people have been trying to deliver to ecology over many hours of hearings. So in the past week, there have been, by my count, about 12 hours of hearings. It's been sort of a remarkable outpouring of opposition to this project. And ecology has gotten more than an earful from people in Kalama and their allies all over the region, urging the agency to deny the project.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about the latest developments in the five-plus year saga to build the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington. So far it sounds like the SSEIS that Ecology has put out is on the right track, but I understand that there's some other problems that you all and the opponents of the methanol refinery are not pleased with. So what are some of the other issues that are included in the SEIS that are problematic?
There's a really hard-hitting article from Sightline Institute that went up yesterday that I would direct people to that I think spells this out really well from Eric DePlace. It's entitled Calama Methanol, quote-unquote, Benefits Assume Catastrophic Climate Failure. And so one of the core issues with the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement is, I guess I'll put it this way, the first half of the analysis says, here's all the pollution from the refinery, from the fracking, from the downstream use of the methanol, and it adds up to these millions and millions of tons of greenhouse gas pollution each year. That's fundamentally where the analysis could and probably should have stopped, because that's knowable, that's reasonably foreseeable, and that's a huge impact on the environment, on the global climate, and it's out of step with what Washington is trying to do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Essentially, it's a catastrophic climate failure. Now, what Ecology then proceeded to do was to take a kind of hazy look into the next 40 years of energy policy decisions globally, including in overseas markets, specifically in China, where this methanol would be headed. And they essentially projected that no one would do anything to curb the massive use of fossil-based methanol, fossil-based plastics and fuels. And they more or less assumed that we would drive ourselves full speed off a climate cliff, not really attempting to correct course. And this was the reference point against which they measured the Northwest Innovation Works project. And against this reference point, they said, well, Northwest Innovation Works would be slightly better than a fully coal-based future. So this is a trick that pretty much every fossil fuel proposal in the Northwest in the history of the Thin Green Line struggle has attempted. You know, the coal export proposal in Longview attempted to argue that its coal was cleaner than coal in China. So even the coal industry tried to argue that it would reduce greenhouse gas emissions through displacement of coal in China. That's how hackneyed this argument is. The Tesoro Savage oil train terminal in Vancouver, when it proposed its 360,000 barrel per day oil train terminal, it argued that it would have lower carbon oil coming from the Bakken formation in North Dakota. But no one in their right mind would say, hey, you know, let's build half a Keystone XL worth of oil trains, you know, in a huge pipeline on rails, and let's call that a win for the climate. No one would have bought that, and no one did buy that. In fact, Ecology voted against that project when it came up for a vote. We see the same argument coming from Jordan Cove LNG in Southern Oregon, where they try to say we're going to be displacing quote-unquote dirtier forms of fossil fuel. In reality, these projects, when they soak up capacity in the energy market, they're also likely to push out cleaner alternatives. And that's something that this analysis did not consider. And that's what we think is one of the really central flaws. It did not, for instance, look at a case in which climate goals are taken seriously and a 2 degrees Celsius goal is met or exceeded. And the state of Washington, it's the policy of Washington to try to meet that goal. So we think it's strange that the Department of Ecology didn't try to pull that in and tack towards that goal in developing this analysis. And we think if they did, you know, it would have been even clearer that this project is not consistent with the goal. And then even on a more fundamental level, it's very, very dubious to project 40 years into the future and to say with any level of surety how things are going to go. I mean, I think everyone listening could look back on the last 6 to 12 months and with some mix of horror and awe and recognize that what we've been through was extremely difficult to predict and dislocating for many, many people. And looking forward for 40 years and to say there is no other future to compare against other than one that is based on a dramatic locked-in commitment to coal or gas or both. That's capitulation to a catastrophic climate failure that, you know, we don't think that that should be the policy of Washington or the basis for approving what would be the world's largest gas to methanol refinery. And so this is something that ecology has heard again and again. People have eloquently and using many different metaphors have described this problem for the state of Washington. So we hope that they acknowledge in their final environmental impact statement that at the very least this idea of displacing coal is unsure. And, you know, ideally that they acknowledge that what is sure is that this refinery would produce a massive amount of pollution, and that pollution cannot be in line with Washington's greenhouse gas goals.
Oh, I find it a little ironic that in the midst of this projecting that China will be continuing to use coal, it sounds like, to make plastic unless they get this methanol from Calama, that recently China has announced that in 45 years it will be carbon neutral. I mean, this is a decision that just happened the week of September 21st. So I wonder if you think that might have some impact on the way that ecology rethinks some of their thinking.
That's a very important point. I mean, you know, the BBC reported just 2 days ago that, you know, China has made, the government of China has made this commitment to being carbon neutral by 2060 and to reach the high point of their emissions by 2030. These are steps in climate policies which are not reflected in the assumptions in the supplemental environmental impact statement. And so, yes, these are important differences with the 40 years projected in the supplemental environmental impact statement and the reality of what is going to have to happen in order to avert the worst impacts of climate change. And it appears that, you know, the government of China is considering taking meaningful steps, and hopefully with a change of administration or you know, change of attitude, the United States is going to be taking steps as well. Certainly a lot of the world is taking this problem very seriously. I was really heartened to hear so many people, you know, for hours and hours and hours, speaking from the heart, but also with a deep knowledge of what this crisis now means for people in the Northwest. I think, you know, one person said it, you know, this just got very real for a lot of people, you know, people on the Gulf Coast and a lot of people, I should say, throughout the Northwest and throughout the United States have experienced climate crises firsthand for a long time. But I think it obviously hit many people very hard in the last several weeks. And many, many people spoke to their firsthand experiences of the fires and the experiences their families were having, being evacuated or dislocated or being unable to go outside because of the severe health impacts they were experiencing from the dense wildfire smoke. These impacts are going to drive real changes in our energy future. And to assume that no one is going to course correct is both dismal and probably unrealistic. And that's why we think ecology should take a step back and either acknowledge it's uncertain or develop a new case that acknowledges some level of climate responsibility going forward. It doesn't make sense to simply compare everything against the worst possible thing, which is, you know, making plastic out of coal and set that as the benchmark and say, well, everything that's better than that is okay. You know, that's not how we're going to ever address the climate crisis.
A lot of people seem to be surprised that ecology came up with this because ecology is relatively respected, I was under the impression. In fact, I talked to Sally Keeley a few weeks ago, and this is before the SEIS was being released. She sounded like she was a little bit skeptical about what ecology would do, but she did say she respected their scientists. And ecology has come out on the scientifically accurate side of these issues a lot in the past. What do you think is motivating them, if you can read their mind or whatever, to make these rather stretched and kind of tenuous assumptions about the future.
Yeah, I mean, there's a place where I think the science stops and the sort of crystal ball economics begin. And that's where it gets a lot more tenuous. You know, if you look at the hard reality of what this refinery would do, it would cause more fracking. That fracked gas would get piped to this refinery. There would be a large amount of pollution created from turning this fracked gas into methanol. The methanol would go overseas, it would be burned or turned into plastic. That plastic would be used, and it would then, in all likelihood, either be burned in incinerators or would be disposed of or end up in our oceans, as so much plastic does, or polluting the environment. This is a picture of dramatic pollution, and I think ecology's analysis demonstrates that pollution picture fairly clearly. And so in that sense, their scientists did a good job of laying that out and putting it together. You know, there are places where we think they could have done better. For instance, we think that the picture of how much methane escapes could have been clearer. Ecology chose to rely on what's called, you know, sort of bottom-up analyses of how much methane escapes, where they take equipment that kind of sniffs for methane leaks, and they go around the different equipment involved in fracking, and they go sort of piece of equipment by piece of equipment. Whereas when you fly over with some more sophisticated observation equipment, you get a better picture for unexpected leaks and kind of the overall amount of methane that is escaping a larger operation. And those top-down measurements are often more robust. And so we think that, you know, using those top-down assumptions and measurements would have been a better way and frankly a higher number for methane leakage that they could have used. Regardless, you know, I think whether you use the lower methane or higher methane, it's a staggering amount of pollution. I think where the analysis departed from that was relying on a hypothetical future displacement of coal, was ignoring methanol's displacement of cleaner energy, potentially. And then, you know, fundamentally, and Eric DePlace made this argument in his article, the analysis fails to acknowledge that when you dump a large amount of fossil fuel onto a market, you actually induce consumption of that fossil fuel. So dumping fossil-based methanol onto the market may very well just simply drive more consumption of fossil fuel. This is a strange kind of part of the economics that I don't really understand why that wasn't more acknowledged in their analysis. So there are some things we just simply don't understand entirely or agree with in how ecology reached their conclusion or reached this part of the analysis. And so I think what's really important is there are aspects of this environmental impact statement that are absolutely guaranteed to occur. And all of those parts are the pollution aspects of this project. You know, the state of Washington is in a position to control whether this refinery gets built and creates millions of tons of greenhouse gas pollution each year. Beyond that, the state of Washington has little control over predicting 40 years of trade wars, overseas energy policy decisions, climate policy, or, you know, wild swings in energy markets. This is a question about locking in a massive amount of fracked gas infrastructure. And, you know, this project would have just a staggering appetite for fracked gas, a huge draw pulling fracked gas out of British Columbia, Alberta, and the U.S. Rockies. It's deeply, profoundly at odds with where we should be going if we intend to limit the use of fossil fuels, limit the amount of fracking, and limit the amount of climate-changing pollution going into the atmosphere.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about the latest developments in the more than 5-year saga to build the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington. I'd like to talk a little bit about these hearings that have been going on for the last week and a half, I guess. There's a comment period that's going on until October 2nd, I understand, where the Department of Energy is accepting comments from the community, and it should be really the global community since this is going to affect the world. So I wanted to talk a bit more about that process and how these virtual hearings that the Department of Ecology has been holding, where people have been able to give, quote, live testimony, how that's been going.
Well, it's been a remarkable week, hours and hours and hours of testimony, you know, coming from people all over the region. One thing I should say is when people from Kalama are speaking, they are most often speaking in opposition to the project and with a really deep knowledge of this company's track record, with a knowledge of its false statements in the past, and also with a really clear sense of what the impacts would be for their community and for the global climate. And so they've really urged ecology to cut through the smoke and the fog and to look clearly at what is assured, what will really happen if this refinery gets built in their town. And so, you know, what they pointed to over and over is that there's a guaranteed pollution impact here that is profound, that would put this refinery among the top polluters in the state of Washington for its in-state pollution alone. You know, you mentioned John Flynn earlier. He said something that I just think is kind of brings it to a down to the river level. He said, I just have a hard time imagining myself in my fishing boat out there in the Columbia River, you know, casting my line in the shadow of this huge refinery. And that image sort of struck me. It's remarkable to hear him testify about things like ocean acidification. This guy is retired from working in the railroad industry and is an avid fisherman and lives in Kalama. And like so many others in Kalama, he has educated himself about the impacts of this project and speaking to his community and helping people understand that the impacts of this project are both local and global. And I think they've stitched together a narrative that is really compelling about why this project deserves opposition. And so they were speaking to the Department of Ecology, but I think it's important for everyone to realize that this is a statewide decision, and you know, Governor Inslee needs to take notice here. On his watch, you know, it's very important that the state of Washington not sign off on what would be a massive, massive climate polluter and a decades-long commitment to enormous fracked gas consumption and pollution. You know, he said that he can't in good conscience support a project that would be this type of infrastructure commitment to, you know, decades of fossil fuel use. So the time is fast approaching when the state of Washington is going to have to make a decision here. And, you know, it's really critical that Governor Inslee, Director Watson from the Department of Ecology, and the staff of the Department of Ecology see clearly that this project threatens Washington's greenhouse gas goals, and it threatens the community of Kalama. This is one of the biggest decisions that Washington will make when it comes to legitimately trying to meet its greenhouse gas goals. I mean, if you think about all the efficiency measures, all the other work that's happened in the state of Washington, to tack on a refinery that would use a staggering up to 320 million cubic feet of gas per day, again, more than all the gas-fired power plants in Washington combined, it's a giant leap backward for the state in trying to address its greenhouse gas pollution issues. So again, you know, through these hearings, I think there were something like 11 or 12 hours of testimony. The vast majority of people who testified, I think the ratio was something like 2-1 or 3-1, it was more like 3-1, were testifying in opposition to this project. There were people from, you know, from northern Washington, from Oregon, from eastern Oregon, from eastern Washington, and particularly from Clark and Cowlitz County, who spoke up very eloquently and passionately, urging the Department of Ecology to say no to this. But also, I think, speaking to Governor Inslee, that the time for leadership is now on this project. It's time to steer Washington away from this type of mega polluter. One of the local leaders in Portland, I thought, did a really nice job. And it's Denine O'Rourke from 350 who said, you know, it's embarrassing to have Washington considering permitting a massive fracked gas refinery, you know, when we've just been through this catastrophic wildfire disaster. It makes no sense. It's this level of cognitive dissonance that we even have to be debating this right now, when most people are struggling with what we've just been through. Yeah, this is a really critical time, and I feel like the hearings sent a super clear message to ecology, which hopefully they've received.
I tuned into part of the hearing the other day, and I was very pleased to hear a lot of what I was hearing, but there were also the usual suspects who I have a feeling a lot of people were testifying on salary. They work for some of the unions that think they're going to benefit from building this refinery, and there are also some of the, I guess, the political hacks in Kellett's County and Lewis County who also spoke. And the thing that really struck me about the way they were speaking, some of it was things I've heard in other hearings. They talk about the science, like they understand the science in this SSEIS, even though you're questioning whether they actually read it, and accusing people like you and Kate Murphy and Deneen and John Flynn of not understanding the science and just being prejudiced against this refinery for all kinds of strange reasons. And the other thing that they talk about the jobs, and it's the same thing over and over. But what I've been noticing that's different is they keep talking more and more about how this is really going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And there was one guy who said the worst crisis right now we're facing is the climate crisis. And yet he was seeing that building this methanol refinery was going to mitigate the climate crisis. And it seems to me that this level of, I guess I think of it as science denial, is actually escalating over the last hearing. I'm wondering what your sense of that was.
Yeah, I mean, Northwest Innovation Works is really, and their backers are leaning into this upside down world where the solution to the climate crisis is building the world's largest fossil gas to methanol refinery. It's dumping fossil based methanol on the global market on a huge scale. If that sounds counterintuitive and wrong, it's because it is. And, you know, we're really disappointed that ecology's, you know, in some ways given them fodder for this by setting the bar so low and just saying, well, anything that's slightly better than coal is good enough. And that's not the bar. You know, that's not what's going to get us to anything resembling, you know, a climate future we can live in. When they talk about, you know, a net global benefit, and that's the term they've used over and over, that's what they're measuring themselves against. They're measuring themselves against, imagine everyone driving full speed as fast as they can off a coal-powered, you know, climate cliff. And what they are proposing is to veer ever so slightly off that path and take a slightly less steep cliff that's gas-based methanol. Both of these paths are profoundly unacceptable and do not protect the climate. They do not protect future generations. And so we just think that this whole scenario of pouring fossil fuel into the global market is wrongheaded. And it's beyond a false solution. It's actively destructive. And so this is the challenge that people are facing is, you know, is the state of Washington really going to buy this? I mean, it strains credulity. And again, you know, I just have to point out that some of these same folks made the very same argument when it came to exporting 44 million tons of coal from Longview. Some of these same backers were there to say, you know, shipping our coal overseas to China will cause them to burn slightly less of the dirtier coal coming from China itself, and that would save the climate. You know, no one in their right mind would say digging up and shipping millions and millions of tons of coal, you know, hundreds of millions of tons of coal over the lifetime of the project is good for the climate. Ultimately, we need to be weaning ourselves off these fossil fuels altogether. Someone has to start keeping it in the ground. And most people look to the state of Washington and to Governor Inslee, who ran for president, on the idea that Washington could and should and has been a leader in trying to, you know, set a standard for how we can grow the economy and be a leader on climate. And this is absolutely contradictory with that. So it's the hearings have been interesting because everyone tries to claim that sort of high ground of we're the ones who are going to deal with climate. But, you know, the people who've spent years and years being activists or taking this seriously and working hard on these issues, they see right through this because they've seen it all before. They've seen every fossil fuel company try to make this claim that, oh, we're a little bit better than coal, so give us a permit. At this moment, it's just really critical that the state of Washington not fall for this ruse.
What do you think is the chance? I mean, I don't want to be a cynic, but I've watched all these other permits get approved eventually that there's no reason it would seem for that they should be getting approved. Do you think that Department of Ecology has the potential to do something different than either the county, Cowlitz County, or up in Pierce County in Tacoma, where the Tacoma LNG facility has gotten its final approval and looks like it's very close to getting built?
Yes, the potential is there because, you know, the pollution impact of this project is very clear. There are other flaws in this proposal. One, you know, the in-state pollution from this project would be roughly 1 million tons of greenhouse gas pollution each year. Northwest Innovation Works claims that they would mitigate that. Now, mitigating 1 million tons of pollution each year is not a trivial thing. And, you know, what they proposed is a voluntary mitigation framework, which is really pretty toothless. If you look at there are essentially no details in the plan. And we're very concerned that while ecology sort of indicates that, yeah, I mean, theoretically someone could do this, there's no clarity and certainly nothing to sink your teeth into to show that it will occur. And for the state to conclude that this project will meet the state standards, will protect the climate and Washington shorelines, there would have to be a much, much deeper level of specificity with regard to the mitigation. And that's simply not there. So I think that there are other reasons, you know, setting aside this whole global climate issue, I think that there are also other reasons why, you know, this project is very flawed. And I think there are other decisions to be made about the project. You know, they're ultimately, the state of Washington is going to have to make decisions about other issues that relate to this project as well. And I think that Governor Inslee and his agencies are going to have to decide in a variety of venues whether this project is consistent with Washington's clean energy future.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about the latest developments in the long saga to build the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington. Well, in our last few minutes, Dan, what can listeners do to become involved in the struggle? I understand there's one more comment writing workshop that you and Powered Past Frack Gas are sponsoring. So what can people do?
There's a comment writing workshop on Monday, and that's at 6 p.m. That's Monday the 28th at 6 p.m. So should be not too late after you hear this interview.
We're recording this on September 24th, so I'm hoping to have it up on the web by this evening. So people may be listening to it over the weekend, so you could get yourself engaged on September 28th. I also want to mention that prior to the actual comment writing workshop, there's going to be a screening of a slideshow that I produced to go along with the documentary I did last year about Kalama Methanol and Tacoma LNG. So people can watch that slideshow and then migrate over to the Zoom meeting for the comment writing workshop.
Yes, I encourage folks to tune in for the slideshow as well. As part of the workshop, there'll be a couple folks speaking who are very knowledgeable about the project, and they can help you if you're interested in learning more, but also writing detailed comments to the Department of Ecology. And so at this point, now that the hearings, the oral comment hearings have closed, we are really encouraging people to weigh in through writing comments to the department. And there's a couple ways you can do that. The Department of Ecology has a website where if you are interested in writing a more detailed comment, you can do it that way through the Department of Ecology's website. They have a web form that's set up. If you type in through Google, ecology in the space and then NWIW, their website will pop up and you can see how to comment there. And then if you'd like to just submit a very simple form comment, we also have a way to do that through powerpastfractgas.org/Kalama. And we'll have links there as well to Ecology's website. So that's a good one-stop shop also.
And the deadline for comment writing is when?
October 2nd is the deadline for submitting comments. So we encourage everyone to weigh in then. Already, you know, there are thousands of comments submitted, the vast majority of them in opposition to this project. And, you know, there's an outpouring of concern that in the midst of what is clearly becoming a worsening climate crisis, that the state of Washington could be at risk of making a really serious mistake by permitting this project and doing it on the basis of what is really a kind of a ruse, a deception, that we should commit to a huge polluter based on the expectation that somewhere else in the world, someone will do something worse anyway. That's a pretty dark view, and it more or less assures, if we all move on that path, that no one will ever make any progress in addressing the climate crisis. It locks us in the same way that building this infrastructure would lock us in. That worldview locks us into a climate future that most of us saw a snippet of in the last few weeks. You know, I had an opportunity to go down to Phoenix and Talent and saw a little bit of what happened in Southern Oregon. And it made me think a little bit about what more I could have done personally to stop where we are today with the climate crisis. And I know that in 20 years, someone will look back on our generation and ask the same question, what we could have been doing today. And I just have a hard time believing that someone will look back and say, boy, I wish they had built that methanol refinery. It's untenable, that position, that the solution to what we are seeing is the construction of the world's largest fracked gas to methanol refinery. Ecology has to know that doesn't meet the straight face test.
I want to talk a little bit more in the last few moments, Dan, about your trips down to Southern Oregon, because I understand you were running supplies down there from Portland. And I just wanted to get a sense of what it was like when you were down there and what people are doing and how we up here in Portland and the rest of the listeners anywhere where you are can help the people in Southern Oregon to rebuild and to reclaim the lives that they want to have.
The first thing I want to say is just that the people in Southern Oregon who have jumped into action and the people all across Oregon who have jumped into action, I am so impressed with everyone who has, you know, in terrible circumstances, leapt into helping each other. It's, you know, just incredible to watch. There are people who've set aside their own personal difficulty and trauma and dislocation to just work long hours, day after day, since this crisis has deepened, to help one another. In the Rogue Valley, where they were really severely impacted, a fire that burned through Phoenix and Talent, the Alameda fire, and there are other fires burning, you know, around them, the Obenchain fire, which burned over part of the pipeline route. You know, obviously we had fires up here closer to Portland, and the fires that burned all over the state were tragic and taking lives, but the situation in the Rogue Valley was particularly hard-hitting. There's something called the Rogue Valley Relief Fund that's been set up through the MRG Foundation. That's a really good way to help. The folks at Rogue Climate have been helping to steer this, and many people are familiar with Rogue Climate. They have been helping to steer the coalition that has been working to stop the Jordan Cove LNG project and the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. And one of the starkest and darkest ironies of this whole thing, you know, Rogue Climate's office burned to the ground in a climate fire in the middle of this. And you can read a really powerful article from Ali Rosenbluth about this in the New Republic. And she's one of the lead staff for Rogue Climate. For your listeners, I just want to say thank you to the many people already who have donated supplies, who've donated money. You know, there have been vans and trucks going in many different directions, you know, to Woodburn, to Cottage Grove, to Warm Springs, to obviously to Jackson County and
McKenzie River.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a strong effort, but I also want to just say this is going to go on for a long time. And so I know that over the course of the next several months to year or more, people can listen into your show and through KBOO and other places to learn how we can help to sustain the recovery from this and build resiliency for the long haul, you know, which is going to have to be part of our climate movement going forward.
Well, one last thing. Can we, again, let people know how they can attend the meeting on Monday where they can learn how to write comments to oppose the methanol refinery in Kalama, and also watch a documentary slideshow which will provide background both on the Kalama struggle and also the struggles in Tacoma, both to stop methanol originally and now their fight against LNG.
You can find the No Methanol Comment Workshop. It's on September 28th through the Sierra Club website. There is an RSVP page. I encourage folks to RSVP there. When you do, you'll get sent back a link. We can post that link also through this website here.
Yeah, as soon as I get the link, I'll put it on the website so you can just come to the Locus Focus page and find out. Dan, it's always great to talk to you. I think every time we talk, things are getting harder and harder. I hope maybe the next time we talk, we'll have turned a corner.
I hope so too. And I just, you know, I really appreciate the attention you and your listeners have paid to these issues over many, many years. Part of the reason that we can think critically about these false claims that Northwest Innovation Works is now making is that we have a long experience with these claims from the fossil fuel industry, that we can look back and see that Jordan Cove has tried to make the same claim, and Tesoro Savage made the same claim, and that Millennium Coal made the same claim. Seeing this same song and dance from Northwest Innovation Works, you know, it's frustrating. It's disappointing to see ecology given any credence. But I think, you know, we continue to have hope that we can hold this line for the people in Kalama and for the state of Washington. And really, you know, it's very, very important that Governor Inslee and the Director of Ecology hear from us and know that they have our support in making the right decision, but also the expectation that at this moment in the climate crisis, we are not going to stand for this type of mistake being made.
Well, Dan, thanks for all the work you're doing. And thanks so much for joining us today on Locus Focus.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO during this fall pledge drive or renewing your membership. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online to kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Once again, thanks again for supporting KBOO. Next week, we'll be rebroadcasting the interview I did with Chinook Elder and Tribal Council Member Sam Robinson. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.